That sad song you've been singing at the gas pump?
How do you solve a problem like high oil prices?
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Bob Moon. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Tuesday, April 17th.
Coming up, what traders and TV reporters mean when they say profit-taking.
How much red ink come from those white lies on your taxes?
And one morning coffee ritual that may surprise you.
Those stories and more are coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
There was an unexpected drop last month in housing starts, which is econ speak for groundbreaking on new homes. But permits for home construction reached their highest level in 3.5 years. That's where we'll start now with Julie Niemann, analyst at Smith Moore & Company. She's with us from St. Louis. Good morning.
Morning, Jeremy.
So is this a bad sign for the housing market that there was a dip in March, or a good sign?
No, really, it's consistent with a very slow recovery, but a recovery nonetheless. The economy really doesn't move in a straight line. There are going to be fits and starts, but the evidence is that we're slowly heating, and that's housing permits going up. It's only half the pace we need to be healthy, but at least it's the right direction.
At least it's the right direction. And let's talk about something else that's happening this morning. President Obama is going to announce some new plans to crack down on oil market manipulation, try to bring down prices. He wants to boost funding for some federal regulators and increase penalties on market manipulators. Tell us in layman's terms what that means and whether it would do anything to bring down prices.
Well, there has to be a big difference between speculation, which is a good thing. They provide orderly markets in the commodities, and manipulation. And there is some. There's using financial instruments with little or no collateral, no disclosure, no regulation, no reporting, and it distorts pricing instead of just supply and demand. But the big reason prices are up is because the value of the dollar has plunged over the last 10 years. 10 years ago, oil was at $26 a barrel. Now it's $105. If our currency was strong, the price would be much lower in dollar terms. But the manipulators, yes, they're out there. And the gurus say that's to the tune of about $20 a barrel.
Hmm. Julie Niemann, analyst with Smith Moore & Company. Thanks as always.
You bet.
The World Bank is getting a new president. Jim Yong Kim, who's currently the head of Dartmouth College, will be taking over the Washington-based global lending institution beginning this summer. He got the nod despite some vocal pushback from developing countries who wanted a non-American to get the job. The World Bank is charged with promoting growth in developing nations. On the line with us is BBC economics correspondent Andrew Walker, who spoke to the incoming World Bank chief. Good morning.
Good morning, Bob.
Andrew, this is clearly a much different kind of leader than the World Bank has seen before, a Korean-born, American-educated doctor with public health expertise. What does he bring to the table?
It is very striking, isn't it? Previous World Bank presidents have always been American, but they have either been politicians or they have been financiers. He is neither of those. What he does have is expertise as a development professional, which is new. What he doesn't have, that has made some people a little critical, is wider experience of economic development issues, which is the mainstream of the bank's activities. Though having said that, health is an important business at the bank as well.
How does Dr. Kim counter critics who accuse him of being anti-growth?
He says that this goes back to a book that he jointly edited 10 years ago, which was called Dying for Growth, which was critical, it must be said, of what he saw as sometimes being an unrestrained pursuit of economic growth without adequate consideration for the impacts that the growth has on poor people. He says, however, all he's saying at the time was growth is not enough. He says he is in favour of economic growth and in particular of capitalist market-led economic growth.
The BBC's Andrew Walker, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Bob.
Isaac Newton's law of gravity appears to be hitting Apple's stock. The company's shares dropped about 4% yesterday. Its five-day losing streak has wiped out some $60 billion in Apple's market value. But analysts aren't calling what's happening gravity. They're using a different term to explain the drop: profit-taking. Marketplace's John Dimsdale explains.
Profit-taking is when investors who got in early on a rising stock want to cash out. That fits Apple's stock performance, which is up 43% this year, fueled by exploding sales of iPhones and iPads. James Cox is a Duke University securities professor.
For those who believe in active management and timing when you buy and when you sell stocks rather than just going in for the long haul, now's a good time to take advantage of that terrific run-up that Apple's had over the last many, many months. Step back, see where the market's going to hit a low, and then buy the stock again.
Some analysts are predicting Apple's string of electronic hits is unsustainable, but Cox explains that the term profit-taking is used when the stock's downturn is expected to be temporary. In the long run, he says, Apple is still a good investment. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
And now to a few stories about taxes on this tax day. Not to sound pushy, but you have until midnight to take care of your taxes. I'm guessing there are a few within the sound of my voice who might be thinking about deducting a phony business lunch or maybe padding their mileage. Jennifer Collins reports on small-time tax cheats and what they cost the government.
In public radio, we love to offer incentives for your generosity. Tote bags, coffee mugs, tax write-offs.
Donate your old car to KPCC and get a tax deduction for yourself.
And it may seem tempting to tell the IRS you've given more than you actually have. Neil Hecht did.
I just lied and added an extra $5 to my charitable donations.
Hecht says that brought down his taxes by $14. He says he only did it once or twice, 20 years ago.
For me, you know, it was 14 bucks. Who the hell gives a damn about $14?
In its most recent report, the IRS estimates improper deductions cost around $17 billion a year. That works out to about $55 for everyone in America, which makes Hecht's tax dodge laughable.
By $14?
Richard Smallbeck is a law professor at Duke.
The time it takes you to figure out how much you need to cheat in order to save yourself $14, you could have mowed your neighbor's lawn or something, and it would have been less work and equally remunerative.
I think everybody fudges at least once in their lifetime on their taxes.
Tax lawyer Kelly Phillips Erb says the IRS often gives taxpayers the benefit of the doubt. It's the flagrant disregard for the tax code that gets people in trouble.
There's a saying that we often say in the tax world, which is pigs get fat and hogs get slaughtered.
And she says shady deductions usually only save pennies. As for Neil Hecht, he says he's changed his ways. Did you ever feel guilty for doing this?
I'm not sure.
Today, he's the chief financial officer of a regional bank. He asked me not to use the name of the bank because, you know, cheating is not the kind of word you want in the same sentence as CFO, even if it was only $14. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Besides the tax rules we're all aware of, some American residents are getting ready for another potential rule that's already creating some trouble down on the Mexican border. From KUT in Austin, Texas, Nathan Bernier reports.
The IRS is trying to hunt down tax evaders. In order to do this, they created a deal with other countries. They'll track down information on U.S. banks, and the IRS will get information from banks in other countries. But here's the problem.
As you may know, Mexico is undergoing a period of unfortunate political instability, and a significant number of those clients are concerned about information being shared by the Internal Revenue Service with Mexico's tax authority that could be placed into the wrong hands.
That's John Dorsey. He's a tax attorney in Austin, and his client list includes many wealthy Mexican citizens. By the wrong hands, he means the drug cartels.
The real risk in Mexico is kidnapping and security.
Some Mexican nationals are already pulling out their money, and that scares banks, according to John Heasley with the Texas Bankers Association. His informal survey suggests Texas banks hold at least $20 billion in deposits from foreigners, and most of that comes from Mexico.
Many banks have 40, 50, 60, 70% of their deposits. Obviously, it is more extensive in places like Laredo and San Antonio. If that kind of capital leaves, it could cause a liquidity crisis.
Opponents of the proposed rule have some powerful political allies, including Florida Senator Marco Rubio and both senators here in Texas, John Cornyn and Kay Bailey Hutchison. But others say the banks are just trying to scare people.
I think their claims are greatly exaggerated.
Rebecca Wilkins is with Citizens for Tax Justice, a nonprofit that helps low and middle income families. She thinks depositors have nothing to fear from regulations as long as their money is legitimate.
I think those are depositors who are hiding their money and not paying taxes on it in their home country. And I wonder, do we really want to protect a bank whose primary business is facilitating tax evasion?
The IRS will not comment on the rule and won't say when it could take effect. But either way, banks will not have to start reporting interest paid to foreigners anytime before January 1st. In Austin, I'm Nathan Bernier for Marketplace.
You a fan of Star Trek, Jeremy?
I've never seen much Star Trek, so I'm not going to say that I'm not
a fan.
But I just saw Star Wars for the first time a few years ago.
Oh, man, you lead a sheltered life. Well, for listeners who are, we have a big announcement. The stars will be aligning in London this October, so here's your chance.
To boldly go where no one has gone before.
A big fan convention in London will mark the first time that all five Star Trek TV captains will be appearing on the same stage together. William Shatner, Patrick Stewart, Avery Brooks, Kate Mulgrew, and Scott Bakula. But if you're planning to grab some easy autographs, think twice. They're expecting between 10 and 15,000 strange new life forms to attend.
Okay, Bob, let's take a little trip down Imagination Lane here. Imagine it is 1999 and you are a Spanish oil company, mm-hmm. a huge Spanish oil company with operations all over the world. I'm going to call you Repsol.
Okay.
All of a sudden, a big country with lots of oil, Argentina, has a total financial collapse. Remember that? The mm-hmm. big financial collapse in Argentina. So you decide to buy their oil company called YPF. You get a good deal on it, mm-hmm. and everybody is happy.
Yeah.
Until April of 2012, when Argentina decides— That would be right now.
Mm-hmm.
It decides it wants its company back, and its president announces plans to just take it, nationalize it.
Hmm.
That is what happened yesterday, and the BBC's Tom Burridge joins us now from Madrid to explain. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, it seems kind of drastic to just nationalize a big foreign-owned company. Why is Argentina thinking about doing this?
Well, Argentina essentially says this is about its sovereignty, that it's paying a lot of money for its energy costs from importing it from elsewhere, and essentially it wants YPF, that was a national Argentinian company about 10 years ago, to become one again, and it to control the assets of that company rather than it be controlled by Repsol, which is a big Spanish energy company.
And I imagine that this whole thing is not going down very well in Spain.
It's gone down like a lead balloon. I mean, essentially, this has been brewing for the last few days, weeks. I mean, on Friday, for example, Spain put clear warnings out to Argentina, really saying, don't you dare. So I think, in a way, Madrid has been caught by surprise to a certain extent when Cristina Fernández de Kirchner, the Argentinian president, made this announcement yesterday. I mean, Spain's rhetoric so far has been as hostile as they come. The foreign minister here, the Secretary of State, if you like, has been saying that this is a hostile act against Spain and the Spanish people and has promised reprisals, clear and forceful measures, he says.
Well, and I've seen some of the analysts who've talked about this have said, okay, maybe Argentina would win in the short run, but they would create a business climate that no international company would ever want to invest in.
That's right. That's the danger, I think, for Argentina. Argentina and Spain, before this row began to brew, were strong trading partners, political friends. Relations have turned suddenly very, very icy. And if you look at it from a business perspective, what will this say to foreign investors? Are some foreign investors going to look at Argentina, see what they've done with YPF, and actually think, oh, should I invest in Argentina in the future? That's the danger.
Finally, Tom, you know, this is the first time we've talked to you in a while, and it hasn't had to do with the European debt crisis and the problems that Spain is facing right now. I imagine that a situation like this, if a big part of their company gets taken over by Argentina, that wouldn't help Spain's crisis at all.
That's right. YPF being nationalized by Argentina hurts Repsol. Repsol is a big, big, big Spanish company. Spain's economy is really struggling in terms of unemployment, in terms of growth. This is not the kind of issue that Spain's government would want at any time, let alone now.
The BBC's Tom Burridge in Madrid. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
ExxonMobil has sealed a landmark deal with Russia's state oil producer. Exxon CEO Rex Tillerson was in Moscow to announce the deal, which gives the U.S. oil giant access to Russia's vast oil fields. Peter Van Dijk reports from Moscow.
Russia is one of the world's biggest oil producers, pumping more than 10 million barrels per day of oil out of the ground. But as easy to get to oil runs out, Russia needs more know-how to keep the black gold flowing. That's where ExxonMobil comes in. The company boasts some of the most innovative methods in the world for finding oil. So the two sides made a deal. Rosneft will become a partner in Exxon projects in Canada, Texas, and the Gulf of Mexico. Exxon will get access to help develop three vast oil fields in the Arctic. Roland Nash is with Verno Capital in Moscow.
It will depend on how well Exxon handled the Russia risks as to whether it will be a good deal for Exxon or not. It should be, but, you know, there's a lot of Russia-associated risk, and handling the government's always difficult.
ExxonMobil knows the government risks firsthand. The last time it danced with a Russian oil company was a decade ago. That ended with a sour deal and the oil executive in jail. But this deal was signed at Prime Minister Vladimir Putin's official residence. There is no better stamp of official approval than that. In Moscow, I'm Peter Van Dyke for Marketplace.
Back here in Southern California, there were concerns about a disease that turns fruits into small, bitter lumps and slowly kills every tree it infects. It's called citrus greening, and it has ravaged orange crops in Florida for years. Now it appears to have come to California. Sandin Totten of station KPCC in Pasadena reports.
The first victim was found in a suburb just outside Los Angeles. It was a lemon pomelo tree in someone's front yard. It was most likely infected by an imported branch grafted onto the plant, but the disease is usually spread by tiny flies called Asian citrus psyllids.
It's a lime tree.
Tina Galindo works with the California Department of Food and Agriculture. She's searching citrus for samples of the bug to test for disease.
You can see how small this insect is that we're looking for. It's just about the size of a flea.
So small, says Galindo, one gust of wind could blow the bugs clear across town, spreading the infection.
It's a death sentence for the tree. There's no cure. You can't give them antibiotics.
That's Mark Hoddle, entomologist at the University of California in Riverside.
It spreads throughout the entire tree. So once it's infected, it's just a matter of time before it goes into decline and then eventually dies.
So far, that lone lemon tree is the only known case of citrus greening in California. If no other outbreaks pop up, it'll be sweet news for the sour fruit. In Los Angeles, I'm Sandin Totten for Marketplace.
Well, according to a new report in the Wall Street Journal, dark meat chicken is once again rising in popularity compared to its lighter counterparts, Bob. Mm-hmm. And the question is, can the producers keep up? Here to talk with us for our Midday Extra is Marshall Ekblad, who wrote the story for the Journal. Hi, Marshall.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. So what's going on here? Why is dark meat coming back?
Well, it seems to be a combination of factors. In many ways, I think American sort of meat eaters are sort of catching up with the rest of the world, who by and large far prefer dark meat over white meat, almost a complete opposite of what our tastes are here in the States. And the reason is a couple of things, in addition to some of the obvious factors like increasing ethnic populations. We also have just Americans eating more sort of ethnic cuisine than ever, and we also have, you know, along with the sort of rise in popularity of celebrity chefs, a lot more very vocal food types who are talking about the fact that dark meat has more flavor, is easier to cook, and is in fact from certain angles more nutritious.
I wonder how much of this is companies like Chipotle, for example, demanding more dark meat as opposed to just individuals who are developing a taste for it.
You know, it's a good question. That's a little bit tricky to figure out. Chipotle, you're right, does use mostly dark meat. They haven't been incredibly vocal about it. It does seem in some ways like some of the more prominent chefs and folks on some of the food networks and food channels have been prominent about it. It is interesting also to see that purchases within grocery stores are rising. So things like boneless thighs have really risen to a price we haven't really seen before for any extended period of time.
Why did white meat become so popular in the first place? I've always been a white meat guy myself. I don't know exactly why. I kind of feel like it tastes a little better. But where did it get in such popularity?
You know, I think one of the things that really led to the rise in popularity, in addition to folks sort of touting that it's healthier from a standpoint of fat content, it seems like Americans really prefer meat that isn't on the bone. And chicken producers, I think, made the decision in the early 80s to start are taking the breast off the bone. They developed, you know, highly automated and even manual, very efficient manual techniques to pull the meat off the bone. And in some ways, I think what we've seen with the rise in dark meat is consumers here responding to more kinds of boneless meat, which has really grown on the dark meat side, even though it's been there on the white meat side for maybe 20 to 30 years.
So what's the net for the industry? Is this going to be a positive? Is it going to be create a difficulty for the industry?
You know, they're at a little bit of a crossroads right now, and the reason is that breast prices have sort of steadily been coming down as dark meat prices have been coming up. The challenge for the industry is that breast meat is still a little bit more lucrative than dark meat. And so although they are no doubt very happy to see people paying more than they ever have before for things like drumsticks and thighs, I think the industry needs that popularity to keep rising in order to undertake any sort of shift going to birds with smaller breasts or birds with bigger thighs, something like that. The bottom line is they're getting paid more than they ever have before for dark meat, but it's still maybe not quite enough.
Marshall, what's your choice, dark or white meat?
You know, I confess, I'm sort of with the rising exports to Middle Eastern countries. I like the whole bird.
Hmm. Marshall Ekblad of The Wall Street Journal, thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
And finally, to one expert, Bob, who says if you want to make the best coffee, don't go buy it. You should make it yourself. You should use a Bodum French press. Immediately take it off the stove when it's done. Put it in a thermos. Drink it within 2 hours. That advice comes from Howard Schultz, the CEO of Starbucks. He tells Bloomberg Businessweek that rather than going to Starbucks, he makes his own coffee that way every morning.
That is an endorsement.
Very grande. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Bob Moon. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.